Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today we're going to talk about three subgenres in science fiction. Now, Monday and Wednesday, we talk apologetics, we talk theology, how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. But on Friday, as we have been doing for many years now from the very beginning of the podcast, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. It's just fun. It's Friday. We can just have fun and talk about all different kinds of things, maybe learn something new today. So today I want to talk about a genre, science fiction, but in particular I want to talk about some subgenres related to it, right? Because you can have a genre, and then you can have, but it can be broke up into a lot of subgenres. So you can take horror, for example. You know, there's the horror genre, but there's the supernatural thriller, there's the slasher genre, which is just a guy with a knife running around with people. But then it gets even weirder. You have cosmic horror monsters from the deep or from space. It'd be like Cthulhu, Lovecraftian horror, if you will. You can have science fiction horror elements. And so some of these genres do start to overlap with one another. But today we're talking about science fiction, in particular, three of the subgenres. I love science fiction. I enjoyed watching, when I was growing up as a kid, I love Star Wars, right? As a kid, you know, the very first movie, Episode 4, A New Hope, I was just jazzed watching that. Then as I get a little older, though, I came to appreciate the intricacies of Star Trek, in particular, though, Next Generation. I didn't really watch the Star Trek films or the 1960s show. So when I was, 10, 12 years old, I really got into Next Generation with Jean-Luc Picard, the most British Frenchman in the Federation fleet. Make it so. Tea, Earl Grey, hot. And so Star Trek, people always like, what do you like more, Star Trek or Star Wars? Like, you can't compare the two. The only thing they have in common is star, and they happen in spaceships. But they're completely different. Star Wars is a space opera, and in particular, it is a riff on those old Buck Rogers serial adventures, like from like the 1930s and things like that. And also Akira Kurosawa films, like The Hidden Fortress. Star Trek, however, is an anthology series that is more dedicated to exploring particular themes in science fiction. It's not about having some kind of grand space opera or, cowboys in space or something like that, the hero's journey in space. It's about using the frontier of space travel and a utopian setting because the Federation is, this utopia where there's no scarcity of resources. You have all these starships and you can just go around and explore brave new worlds, seek out life and new civilizations to boldly go where no one has gone before. I don't know why I made that turn into Sean Connery doing the Star Trek opening monologue, but hey, whatever. And so I like what it explores. So Star Trek explores, the glistening future. Like when you think of science fiction, Star Trek is one of the first things that come to mind. It takes place in an optimistic, distant future where humanity is this kind of utopia or near utopia. At least we've solved all the problems we have today. And now since we solved those problems, we want to get in big spaceships and go around the universe, to explore new life, and maybe the captain will have a romantic liaison with some green-skinned alien. Kirk versus Picard. No one has the swagger like Captain Kirk. Every sentence, everything he says sounds like it ends with a period. Spock! Khan! All right, so that's enough of Star Trek there, but I want to talk about the subgenres that would deviate away from this kind of standard science fiction. What they all have in common is that they include the word punk, but they're very different. They have the similarities, but they apply different things to science fiction to subvert our expectations with science fiction. Because science fiction isn't just about what would life be like in the year 2400 and how great would it be. Sometimes it imagines alternative universes, or it doesn't necessarily buy into that technology is a utopia. If you look around, look what Facebook and social media has done to us. Technology might make things bad. At least it might have negative effects we don't account for along with the positive effects. So the first one I'll talk about is cyberpunk. So it says here, cyberpunk is a subgenre of science fiction in a dystopian, futuristic setting that tends to focus on, quote, combination of low life and high tech. Features futuristic technology and science, like artificial intelligence and cybernetics, but it's juxtaposed with social collapse, dystopia, or decay. Much of science cyberpunk was rooted in new wave science fiction of the 1960s and 70s with people like Philip K. Dick. In fact, probably one of the most famous examples of early cyberpunk would be Philip K. Dick's story, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The novel takes place in a post-apocalyptic San Francisco, like after a nuclear war, and it follows a bounty hunter named Rick Deckard, who his job is to hunt down replicants, these robots that look like human beings that are almost indistinguishable from humans. You need a sophisticated test to determine whether they're a robot or not by their lack of empathetic and emotional responses. And so he is a bounty hunter who goes out and retire the fugitive replicants, or he kills them. And so Blade Runner, and so this is the story, I should say, by Philip K. Dick, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, right? You make these robots, they look like humans, they act like humans. When they go through a sleep cycle, what do they dream about? Do they dream of electric sheep? You know, so this was then retitled Blade Runner, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in later printings. And then it was later adapted into a movie in 1982 called Blade Runner, starring Harrison Form as Deckard. And so Blade Runner contains a lot of tropes you'll later find in cyberpunk films or things like that. One is that it's dirty and grimy. So when you think about a lot of science fiction, the cities are supposed to be futuristic and bright, and you know they're just like they're this utopia. But what if you had basically like New York in the 1970s, but there were robots and laser guns or flying cars? That would be cyberpunk, right? Imagine it took place in you have the environment of 1970s New York, but you have the technology of the year 2170 in New York. So what would that be like? Remember that cyberpunk is low life and high tech. And so a lot of cyberpunk then is a common theme you'll see in it, especially in films, is neon and rain. There's these huge towering cities of flying cars that are grimy, and there's neon signs everywhere. So that's what's really lighting up everything is neon, and it's always raining all the time. And because of that, a lot of these cyberpunk films and books, a lot of them use noir thrillers. So a lot of them have the cyberpunk setting, but for the plot, they use noir or film noir, noir thrillers. And that goes back to like the 1930s through the 1950s of crime thrillers and dramas that employed this kind of high concept contrast and filming. You know, the detective sits in his office and the light only comes through the blinds. And then the femme fatale walks in. I can't believe she had to walk into my office. Classic noir thrillers include Double Indemnity, The Maltese Falcon. And a lot of the noir thrillers, what makes them different from just classic detective stories is they usually have a downbeat ending. Like it's unresolved, the bad guy gets away, or there's still a sense of injustice at the end of it. That's why you have the film Chinatown, right? I think Chinatown came out in let's see here. I'm always having to look this up for you guys and not have to stall for time. Chinatown was released in 1974, June 20th, 1974. And Chinatown has been called a neo-noir thriller. It came out right after, but it still has that feel, right? Because at the end of it, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. Like, look, you're never going to get to the bottom of the corruption here. So that ends up being combined a lot in these sorts of dystopian cyberpunk films. Another one that I saw recently on a plane was Ready Player One, based on a book. And it's about humanity lives in, it has this advanced technology, like it's like Meta for Facebook. You know, everybody's using VR because the outside world really stinks. Everyone lives in these decrepit slums. So they put on VR to get away from everything. And the VR world is mostly a bunch of retro stuff from the 80s that people enjoy. And you can play as different avatars. But the look and feel of these high-rise slums with futuristic cars and technology, that's very cyberpunk. So Ready Player One, I was actually watching on a plane not too recently. Other common themes in cyberpunk is man against megacore. So in cyberpunk, as opposed to other science fiction, you will have the antagonist is not so much like a corrupt government, right? You think about like Fahrenheit 451, other kinds of science fiction, 1984, Big Brother, where the antagonist is like this corrupt government that is overbearing on people. But in a lot of cyberpunk, the antagonist force is usually a kind of corporation that essentially acts almost without impunity that the government sanctions and allows. So we see this, for example, in Ready Player One. You have the evil company that's trying to take over the Oasis, which is this VR reality that's been created that everybody really enjoys, so they can just fill it up with advertising and things like that. Oh, yeah, and that's also, there's ads everywhere in the neon in cyberpunk. RoboCop would be another example of this. Think about RoboCop, directed by Paul Verhoeven. Your move, creep. That you have the, was it Omnicorp that makes everything and, you know, wants to create the Robo, you know, takes a police officer, Alex Murphy, and basically brings him back to life and makes him, you know, this kind of cyborg RoboCop guy. But, you know, it's the evil corporation all along. That's the real bad guy here. So Man Against Megacorp, Neon and Rain, it's a noir thriller. Outside of the city, you usually have a barren wasteland caused by an apocalypse or man going too far. Flying cars, you got to have flying cars and everything. Fifth Element would be another example, maybe a cyberpunk. Towering cities, flying cars are everywhere. Think about how bad we are with cars today. People are like, well, where's my flying car? I want a flying car. You can, as Neil deGrasse Tyson once put it, there are flying cars. We do have them. They're called helicopters. And they're really hard to learn how to fly. And you need a lot of training and clearance and permission to use them. That's why we don't have flying cars. Because if your car breaks down when you're driving, you just pull off the side of the road. It's not a big deal. If your flying car breaks down, you're in a lot of trouble. So I always find it funny that in these movies, everyone, I mean, you think, oh, it'd be so cool to have a flying car. Yeah, it'd be cool if you had a flying car and it worked all the time and was easy. But if everybody had a flying car, you wouldn't want to step foot outside of your house. All right, so that's the first one. That would be cyberpunk, low life, high tech. The next one would be steampunk. So steampunk is a subgenre of science fiction that incorporates retro futuristic technology and aesthetics inspired by 19th century industrial steam-powered machinery. Steampunk works are often set in an alternative history of the Victorian era or the American Wild West, where steam power remains in mainstream use, or in a fantasy world that employs steam power. So steampunk, you know, it takes science fiction, right? We think, well, what's going to happen in the future? Science fiction also explores alternate histories. What if things were different? What if technology progressed, but it never moved beyond a particular kind of framework, right? Because we go from steam to internal, because you think when science fiction, it goes steam, internal combustion, solar, clean energy, nuclear fusion, crystallic fusion. What was Buzz Lightyear? What did he need? I think he needed a crystallic fusion for his spaceship. We got double A's. And eventually you get unobtainium, right? You get some kind of miracle energy source that can do anything, has no drawbacks, and that's what powers everything. It gets named something like unobtainium because of its unrealistic properties that are involved. But what if you had science fiction where it didn't progress, where it progressed technologically, but it kept the same power framework? So what if you just never got beyond steam, but you got really, really good at steam so you could make advanced technology, but it ran on steam? And that would be steampunk. It's the idea that we set things in a Victorian style. So common tropes in steampunk would be that what's odd here is that the technology progresses. You'll get weapons that are comparable to what we might have in the 20th or 21st century, amazing flying machines, all different kinds of gadgets. So things will continue to progress, but what will always stay the same is steam, brass and cogs, and Victorian ladies and gentlemen. Those will not progress. Even if you're still there, you'll end up with everything, even if it's powered by steam, it won't become sleek. It's got to be yellow brass and cogs spinning on everything. It's, in order to have that steampunk look, you got to have brass and cogs everywhere. And you have Victorian style. In clothing and in behaviors, the main protagonist may be the gentleman adventurer off to explore new worlds in my airship, or the lady adventurer who comes into conflict with people who say, yeah, a lady can't go on adventures, things like that. What are some other kind of common tropes in steampunk? Steampunk literature, both film and books, airships are a big one. It's that the sky is the ocean. in steampunk. You want to go and explore the sky as you would explore the sea in a steam-powered, not practical airship that takes you about. And so oftentimes, though, people will admit that steam can't get all of it working, so they have discovered some kind of magical substance. And one of the problems, though, with steampunk, especially in written literature, is that it can get a little technical. Like, sometimes the authors can really lean into the jargon and spend way too much time trying to explain how things run on steam and how different machines work. Whereas if you do other things like Star Trek, things like that, I mean, they'll still do that, but they just do it a lot quicker but especially they'll use like techno babble that doesn't really have to make sense. And so sometimes that happens in steampunk literature. It's like, look, no, you don't have to do that. At the end of Back to the Future 3, when Doc Brown has the flying, I love it, the end of Back to the Future 3, Doc Brown shows up, the DeLorean has just been destroyed, and you think Doc Brown has been left behind in the Old West in 1885, and then he appears, this time machine, it runs on steam, he tells Marty. So that's a little bit of a steampunky element right there to it. But yeah, sometimes in science fiction, in general, this can be a bad thing. I remember once someone showed me that a friend of theirs had worked on a science fiction book. And I started reading the first page of it. And the entire page, the beginning of the book, was just an explanation about how the main character's plasma rifle worked. This is not an instruction manual. I don't need to know that. Just get me into the story already. So, though, that's a little bit of the steampunk genre of science fiction. Alternate history, alternate futures, timelines, if you will. What if we never went past the steam age? Some film entries that would qualify as steampunk. Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter would be one. Wild Wild West. Remember Wild Wild West with Will Smith, Selma Hayek, and Chris Klein? Let's see. Wild Wild West. Wild Wild West. Everybody's Wild Wild West. All I remember is the song. I wanted to say it was 1999. That is a classic 90s movie. That was my guess, 1999. Because I was 14 years old. So I was just at the threshold of being able to be entertained by these films. It's funny, when I go back and think about older films, like, take for example, Batman and Robin, probably like the worst Batman movie ever. Well, there's some animated ones that are really bad, but Batman and Robin is bad. Unless you go into it thinking, I want to see a campy Batman, then it can work. But if you were looking for the Tim Burton Batman from 1989, he is long, long, long gone. That was 1997. Terrible film. Now I recognize a terrible film. When it came out, I liked it, but I was 12 years old. When you're a kid, it's funny, when you go back and watch some kids' shows, you're like, oh, this is really good. It still holds up. Other kids' shows, you're like, wow, this is terrible. You watch it, Full House does not have a single joke in it. Like, not one. But I was, what, like 9 years old when that came out, 10 years old? Like, oh, okay. My standards are, they're pretty low back then. So Wild Wild West is it's steampunky. It's set in the Old West, but you have like the third act, the climax of the film. There's a giant mechanical doomsday spider powered by steam, futuristic technology with cogs and gears, not as much brass, not as Victorian, but it's the Wild Wild West. And Will Smith is decent enough in it, but when you go back and watch it, it really doesn't hold up today. Finally, another film I want to put in here into the steampunk genre would be Disney's Treasure Planet. That was released back in 2002. And Disney has actually done a lot of Treasure Island adaptations. They did a straight movie back in 1950, just, hey, here's Treasure Island, here's the book. Then in 1996, they have Muppet Treasure Island. And then Treasure Planet, there have been other adaptations of Treasure Island, the Robert Louis Stevenson novel from 1883, that have been placed in outer space. What I like with Treasure Planet, though, is that the spaceships look like, 19th century, 18th century galleons, with sails, and it's all very impractical for going into outer space. But I feel like it's not quite steampunk, but it's this idea, like, what if we kept galleon designs, 19th century naval designs, but put them in space? And it makes for a delightful adventure sense to it. So I'm going to add that one in there. Treasure Planet is steampunk. And finally, we have dieselpunk. So we had cyberpunk, we had steampunk, now we have dieselpunk. It's a similar subgenre of science fiction that combines retrofuturism with other kinds of aesthetics. In this place, it says it combines the aesthetics of diesel-based technology of the interwar period through to the 1950s with retrofuturistic technology and postmodern sensibilities. The term was coined in 2001 by game designer Lewis Pollack. Different than steampunk, the diesel punk kind of literature will have science fiction set in an, instead of an alternate 19th century, it's more of an alternate early 20th century. So you have what looks at first glance to be like something set between 1930 and 1950 because it relies on diesel-based technology, not steam-based technology, but it has a lot of futuristic things that wouldn't actually exist today. A few examples of that would be Captain America. So Captain America, the First Avenger, obviously is set back in World War II, but you've got all this futuristic technology in it because of the Infinity Stone that Hydra has stolen and uses alternate histories. What if World War II had turned out differently if Captain America were there? Other films that have diesel punk would be Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, The Rocketeer. I've talked about The Rocketeer before on the podcast. It is a wonderful film. It just has a great soundtrack to it. It's a great adventure story. There's parts that aren't, not necessarily for the youngest kids, I would recommend, even though it is Disney. This is a family film, and back in the day, family films weren't entirely, like, you know, smooth out on the edges for families. It's got, how do I describe this? Well, it's got some, like, henchmen that are scary, scenes of violence, tad bit of immodesty, if you will. But overall, though, it's still, I still really love it. I think it's a great film. Animated series that would be qualified as diesel punk would be Tailspin. Oh, 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 oh. That's not the Tailspin theme song, but I'm sure if I heard it, it would come right back to me. With Baloo from The Jungle Book. Imagine Disney just sitting around. We need a spinoff of The Jungle Book. How about if we had Baloo from The Jungle Book, but he's a 1930s skipper pilot, dealing with air pirates? Sure, why not? But it has that feel that it has, these old seaplanes and dirigibles, air cannons. So it's supposed to be set in like the 30s, but a completely different 30s with talking bears that fly around. Another example of that, what did I mention here? Oh, Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow would definitely be diesel punk. Finally, Batman, the 1989 film, and Batman, the animated series. I would say that definitely counts as diesel punk, especially Batman the Animated Series, where it's set. It seems like you look at the cars, you look at the building design, Art Deco, looks kind of like the 30s, that kind of Gotham design. That makes sense. Gotham City, right? But then you've got people actually they had guns in Batman the Animated Series. They had to have laser cannons in X-Men. But you have also all this futuristic technology, like Batman has the Bat Computer, for example, even though the setting feels right. So it's retrofuturistic. Retrofuturistic, you can see at first glance, it looks like the past, but they've peppered in all kinds of things from the present or the future to speed things up a little bit. Oh, wait. One more for you in the diesel punk category. Do you remember this one? 2003. It was the last film appearance of Sean Connery. Yeah. Do you expect me to talk, Goldfinger? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Those are the classic days. Goldfinger, man, I love Sean Connery. He's also good in The Rock. That's something another great film with Nicolas Cage. But so this was the last film Sean Connery was ever in, and it was a stinker. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. So it's based on the comic book series by Alan Moore. And basically, it's very diesel punk. It's set in, I want to say that it's set in like the late 19th century, but it's got a lot of diesel technology, cars and submarines and things like that. That's all people describe it. And it's basically, what if you had a Justice League of superheroes, but they were all like 19th century literary characters? So you had a Justice League comprised of Alan Quatermain from the King Solomon Mine series, Captain Nemo, Mina Harker, the vampire, the Invisible Man, Dorian Gray, and Tom Sawyer. At first glance, oh, that would be a super fun movie, and it just doesn't turn out. It does. It. Oh, I remember watching it with friends. It was just so disappointing. That was when I finally hit my prime. You know, I'm 18 years old, and I can tell when a movie's a stinker and when it's not. So, to wrap that all up, we had cyberpunk, low life, high tech, steampunk. What if we stayed with steam power and continued on, kept our Victorian ways, and had flying ships and brass and cogs? And then Diesel Punks, sleek, silver, diesel power, with all kinds of fun things in between there. Thank you guys so much. Hope you enjoyed this Free For All Friday. And yeah, I just hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.